Welcome back to the Deep Dive, especially to you, the learner. We are so glad you're here with us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thrilled to be jumping into this one.
Because usually when we think about hearing damage, you know, there's this expectation of a really obvious physical cause.
Right, like an acoustic trauma.
Exactly. Yeah. Like you go to a wildly loud rock concert, you stand, you know, right next to the speakers, and the next day your ears are just ringing.
Yeah, loud noise goes in, damaged hearing comes out. It's a very straightforward mechanical cause and effect relationship. The sound waves were just too violent.
Right, it's clean. But then you open up your medicine cabinet, and suddenly that simple cause and effect model just, well, it goes right out the window.
It really does. It completely reframes our understanding of what actually puts our ears at risk every single day.
Because we aren't just talking about industrial accidents or sirens here. We're talking about a surprisingly common kind of hidden side effect lurking right in our everyday lives.
Tinnitus.
Yes, tinnitus. That persistent phantom ringing in the ears. And today, our mission is to explore this hidden threat. We are pulling heavily from a really fascinating lecture by Professor Ali Dinesh,
who is affiliated with Florida Atlantic University, the University of Miami, and Labyrinth Audiology. Really incredible source material.
Truly. Because, I mean, most of us know to wear earplugs around jet engines, right? But what if the real threat is a prescription antibiotic or an over-the-counter painkiller or, and this is wild, the tonic water in your evening cocktail?
Yeah, it's definitely a shock for a lot of people to hear that.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can truly grasp how a simple pill swallowed into your stomach can trigger a phantom ringing in your head, we really need to understand the machinery of the ear.
Right, the anatomy. Because hearing is this profound translation of physical energy into chemical and electrical signals.
And we can probably skip the basic mechanics, right? Like most of you listening know how the eardrum, the tympanic membrane, works.
Exactly. And the tiny bones in the middle ear, the malleus, the incus, and the stapes, they vibrate. We get that.
Right. But the real vulnerability is deeper inside, in the inner ear, specifically the cochlea.
Yes. But even beyond the cochlea, we have to recognize the central auditory pathway. It's not just the ear. It's how the signal gets to the brain.
Oh, right. The whole neural highway.
Exactly. So the signal travels from the auditory nerve to the cochlear nucleus complex, then to the superior olivary complex.
Wow. Okay. Lots of complexes.
Right. It is a bit dense. Then it hits the lateral lemniscus, the inferior colliculus, the medial geniculate body, and finally it reaches the auditory cortex, specifically Heschel's gyri, where we actually perceive the sound.
Okay, that is a massive journey. But if we zoom back into the cochlea itself, where the signal starts, Professor Dinesh's materials highlight two main structures in the crosshairs.
Yes, the outer hair cells, or OHCs, and their stereociliary bundles.
And those healthy outer hair cells are basically the microscopic amplifiers of the ear, right?
Precisely. They physically dance and change shape to amplify sounds so the auditory nerve can catch that signal. But to do that work, they need a highly specific fluid environment.
And that brings us to the second structure, which is just fascinating. The stria vascularis.
Yes, the stria vascularis. It's located on the lateral wall of the cochlea in an area called the scala media.
And its main job, according to the source material, is to maintain a very high ratio of potassium ions to sodium ions in the surrounding fluid.
Right, the endolymph.
The endolymph. So it generates the endocochlear potential, it oxygenates the cochlea through these tiny capillaries, and it provides nutrition.
Exactly. It is a highly active, heavily regulated biological system.
So if I'm trying to translate this physiology into, you know, everyday terms, the stria vascularis is basically a complex biochemical battery that powers our entire sense of hearing.
That's a perfect analogy.
And the endolymph is the battery fluid. But here's my question. If the stria vascularis is the battery and the endolymph is the battery fluid, how delicate is this potassium to sodium ratio? Like, is it easily thrown off balance?
What's fascinating here is that this ionic balance is not just delicate. It is the literal driving force of your hearing, and it is under constant precarious management.
Precarious meaning it doesn't take much to mess it up.
Right. The endocochlear potential, that electrical charge created by having way more potassium than sodium, is exactly what allows those outer hair cells to fire.
And if a chemical from a pill enters the blood supply.
Well, the stria vascularis is highly vascularized. It's packed with blood vessels, so the drug flows right into it, disrupts its ability to pump those ions, and the voltage literally drops.
Oh, wow. So the battery is drained.
Exactly. And when the voltage drops, or if the drug is directly toxic to the outer hair cells, the brain stops getting crisp signals.
It loses that input.
Right. And in the sudden absence of normal input, the brain's auditory centers overcompensate. They start firing on their own, and that creates the phantom noise of tinnitus.
That is just, it's crazy how connected it all is. And now that we know how fragile this inner ear battery is, we really need to look at what happens when we introduce modern medication into the mix.
Because we are doing that at an astounding rate.
Seriously. The statistics from the CDC on medication use are staggering. Between 2015 and 2018, 48.6% of people used at least one prescription drug in the past 30 days.
Almost half the population.
Yeah, and it scales up quickly. The same data shows that 12.8% used five or more.
That is a massive amount of chemical intervention coursing through our collective stria vascularis.
It really is. And with medications come side effects, or what the FDA calls adverse drug reactions, ADRs.
And those are categorized on a pretty wide spectrum, right?
Yeah, from mild meaning no hospitalization to moderate, severe, and all the way up to lethal. In fact, the lecture points out that overdoses and adverse reactions are the fourth leading cause of death in hospitals.
Which really highlights that medications are blunt instruments. They have profound physiological impacts.
And our awareness of how they impact the ear has really had to play catch up, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Robert DeSogra, an audiologist who heavily researched this, tracked these auditory adverse drug reactions over the years. In 1993, he noted there were 750 drugs on the market.
Okay.
And only 83 of them had reported ADRs affecting hearing.
But then look at his data from 2008. By his third edition list, we're looking at roughly 2,000 drugs and over 400 adverse reactions related to the ear.
Right, because the sheer volume of medications expanded and our clinical awareness finally got sharper.
And by 2018, the Side Effect Resource Database looked at 996 commonly used drugs. Out of those, 275 drugs, which is 6.5% of them, specifically listed tinnitus or ear noise as a side effect.
Hmm. And the physician's desk reference, the PDR, lists over 220 such drugs, describing everything from transient hearing loss to vertigo and cognitive impairment.
So what does this all mean? I mean, Professor Dinesh's stats show there are over 14,000 total drugs in existence.
Hmm.
Small molecule, biotech, nutraceuticals.
It's a massive chemical landscape.
Almost half of us are taking something every month, and we know these drugs cause ringing. Aren't we basically playing Russian roulette with our hearing?
Well, it's a highly valid concern, but it comes down to a harsh reality of medicine, which is the risk-reward calculation.
Right.
The clinical term for this is ototoxicity, meaning the medication is literally toxic to the ear, causing initial damage to those outer hair cells, a loss of otoacoustic emissions, and ultimately sensorineural hearing loss.
Okay, so if it's a known risk, what specific classes of drugs should you, listening to this right now, actually be aware of?
The heavy hitters are often life-saving. For example, specific classes of powerful antibiotics like aminoglycosides, so your amikacin, neomycin, gentamicin, and macrolides.
Okay, those are the big guns.
Exactly. Used for severe, life-threatening bacterial infections. Then you have glycopeptides like ramoplanin and ticoplanin. And of course, platinum-based anti-tumor and anti-cancer drugs, along with heavy metals.
Okay, so in those life or death cases, the FDA and the doctor are making a calculated choice. Cure the lethal infection, fight the cancer, but risk the inner ear battery. That makes sense.
Right, but there are drugs that aren't for life or death situations, like loop diuretics.
Yeah, furosemide. How does that work?
Well, loop diuretics treat fluid retention and high blood pressure by forcing your kidneys to excrete more sodium and water.
Oh, and the battery runs on sodium and potassium.
Exactly. The stria vascularis relies on a precise balance of sodium and fluid in the endolymph. When a loop diuretic systemically alters your body's sodium, it accidentally drains the battery fluid in your inner ear.
That is terrifyingly logical. But it gets even more common than that. The lecture points out over-the-counter mainstays, NSAIs, and acetyl salicylic acid, which is just everyday aspirin.
Yeah, the mechanism there is a bit different. High doses or chronic use of aspirin can restrict the blood flow in those tiny capillaries, effectively suffocating the stria vascularis.
Just from a headache pill.
Yeah, it induces biochemical stress on the outer hair cells.
And then there are anti-malarial drugs like Claroquine and quinine. Wait, quinine is the bitter flavoring in tonic water.
It is, yes.
Does that mean an innocent gin and tonic combined with an aspirin the next morning for a headache is essentially launching a chemical assault on my outer hair cells?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it is all about cumulative impact and cellular stress. Now, dosage is incredibly important here.
Okay, so I'm not going deaf from one cocktail.
No, a glass of tonic water has vastly less quinine than a medical dose for malaria, but the principle holds true. The combined cumulative effect of over-the-counter meds, supplements, and prescriptions can indeed place undue stress on the cochlea over time.
Right, because you're mixing different agents that all tax the blood supply.
Exactly. You dramatically increase the risk of that battery faltering.
Okay, so an alarmingly huge array of pills, from cancer drugs to aspirin, can cause this phantom ringing. Logic would suggest there must be a pill to cure it, right?
We are definitely always hunting for a magic pill.
And there's a theory regarding corticosteroids, specifically prednisolone. The idea is that it increases the potassium secretion of the stria vascularis.
Right, it's a brilliant hypothesis. If the potassium is the fuel, find a drug that forces the pump to push more potassium, restoring the endocochlear potential.
Fixing the battery, but does it work?
The hard truth is no. In 2014, the American Academy of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery Foundation, the AAOHNSF, published their clinical practice guideline.
And their recommendation is incredibly blunt. They explicitly recommend against pharmaceutical medications, dietary supplements, and transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS, for primary sensorineural tinnitus.
There is no FDA-approved magic pill.
Which brings up a very confusing landscape for the consumer, especially regarding those supplements at the pharmacy.
Oh, absolutely. You often see the United States Pharmacopoeia, or USP, mentioned on labels.
Yeah, they have a massive history, right, dating back to 1888.
Right. And you might see a bright USP verified badge on a bottle of supplements claiming to help with tinnitus.
Here's where it gets really interesting. If the official clinical guidelines say dietary supplements don't work, why do some bottles have that USP verified badge? What is that badge actually verifying, if not that it cures my ringing ears?
That catches millions of consumers off guard. The USP verified mark does not mean clinical efficacy. It verifies the chemical identity, the purity, the strength, and the quality of the raw ingredients.
So they're just confirming that what the label says is in the pill is actually in the pill.
Exactly, and that it doesn't contain heavy metals and it will dissolve properly.
So they're verifying the manufacturing quality, not the medical outcome. According to the AAOHNSF, the clinical efficacy just doesn't exist yet.
Correct. It's a high-quality pill, but it won't stop the ringing.
So if the consensus is that there's no magic pill, how are we trying to find one? Which leads us into the world of clinical trials and animal models.
It's an incredibly difficult world, too.
As of the 2020 to 2021 data, there were 267 clinical trials on tinnitus, testing meds, rTMS, electrical stimulations. But it takes agonizingly long because of the four phases of a clinical trial.
Right. Phase one is healthy people. Phase two is 100 to 200 people with the condition. Phase three is a national program. But it's phase four that is often the most revealing.
The follow-up period.
Exactly. The long-term post-market follow-up after a drug is already approved.
Which implies millions of people are acting as the final testing ground. And it's often in phase four that we discover these auditory side effects, right? Like medications for ED, the
Right.
antibiotic Zithromax, they only showed hearing loss and tinnitus in that lead stage.
It proves just how hard it is to detect ototoxicity early on. People don't connect a slight ringing to a new, unrelated prescription.
So how do we test new treatments for tinnitus before we give them to humans? Professor Danishesh notes that human causes are just too heterogeneous.
Too varied and messy. One person has it from loud music, another from aspirin.
So we rely on animal models. We use reflexive methods, like the acoustic startle reflex, and operant methods, revealing what the animal is actually hearing.
But the challenge is existential. How do you define silence to an animal? Tinnitus is a phantom noise, so we use the SI-PACC paradigm, schedule-induced polydipsia avoidance conditioning.
Okay, walk us through this. How do you prove a rat is hearing a sound that doesn't exist?
Researchers take food-restricted rats, which makes them thirsty. They train the rat to lick a water spout only during perfectly quiet periods,
Okay.
and they train them to avoid licking when a specific external sound is played.
So silence equals safe to drink. Sound equals danger. Stop drinking.
Precisely. They get over 90% accurate. Then they inject the rats with high doses of salicylate, the active component in aspirin, which causes tinnitus.
That one happens.
Placed back in an objectively silent room, the rats drastically reduce their licking. They refuse to drink.
You can't just give a rat a questionnaire and ask, is your ear ringing on a scale of 1 to 10? So the fact that the rat refuses to drink water in a silent room proves it's actively hearing a phantom sound. That is incredible. Does this mean these rats are helping us test those 267 new treatments?
This raises an important question about auditory research. Because it's subjective, we can't measure it with a blood test. These animal models are our only objective window. We give the rat a new drug, and if it starts drinking water again in a silent room, we gauge if the drug turned off the noise. They are the crucial bridge to FDA approval.
Wow. So to bring this all together, the ear is a delicate biochemical battery powered by a fragile balance of sodium and potassium in the stereo vascularis. And every day, medications, antibiotics, loop diuretics, aspirin can act as ototoxic disruptors to our outer hair cells.
And while we want a quick fix, there are currently no FDA-approved magic pills.
But the animal models, like our thirsty rats, are paving the way. So for you listening, the next time you get a prescription or reach for a painkiller, you now have the knowledge to ask your doctor about ototoxicity. You don't have to be paranoid, but you do have to be informed.
Absolutely. You have to weigh the risk to the inner ear against the benefit to your body.
Exactly. And I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. We learned today that out of over 14,000 existing drugs, some like ED meds and Zithromax were only discovered to cause hearing issues late in phase 4 clinical trials. With 267 ongoing studies for tinnitus, what if the exact cure we're looking for is already sitting on a pharmacy shelf, originally designed for a completely different disease, just waiting for the right rat to drink the water and prove it works?